Democratic Party leadership and base has to say, no, President Biden, we will finish the game. We're going to ask you to step aside.
There was an interesting part of the news conference yesterday where President Biden seemed to leave open the door if his closest aides told him to go. Let's play that clip.
Second question related to
bad nights, sir. How can you reassure the American people that you won't have more bad nights, whether they be on a debate stage or on some matter of foreign policy?
Well, I tell you what, the best way to assure them is the way I assure myself. And that is, am I getting the job done? Am I getting the job done? Can you name me somebody who's gotten more major piece of legislation passed in 3.5 years? I created 2,000 jobs just last week. So if I slow down, I can't get the job done. That's a sign that I shouldn't be doing it. But there's no indication of that yet.
No indication of that yet in his answer to Zeke Miller of Associated Press. So if you could respond to that, Bill Fletcher, and talk about who is sticking with him. Very interesting that the squad is sticking with him. I mean, AOC is, though very critical on issues like Gaza, Ilhan Omar, they are sticking with him. The Congressional Black Caucus, they are sticking with him at this point. Talk about all of this.
I think, Amy, that this is not a 25th Amendment situation. I don't think that Biden has lost it. I actually do think there needs to be a new constitutional amendment that says that no one past the age of 80 can run for president. But I think we're looking at a person who is declining, and that's different. I've been asking myself the same question regarding particularly the Congressional Black Caucus, and I think that it's actually similar to what they were often thinking in 2020, which is they're not confident that there's another candidate that actually can bring together the right kind of base in order to win against Trump. And I think that that's actually the wrong argument. I think that going back to something that David said, I think is very profound, that what happened and was very evident in the debate led to a crack in his core. The people that he needs to count on to be out in the field in 100-degree weather, knocking on doors, the people he needs to raise money, the people he needs to speak on his behalf, when their confidence is shaken, that is at this point more critical than what the poll numbers say. Because I don't trust the polls either. I mean, particularly after we were told that Hillary Clinton was going to win in 2016, I just don't trust the polls. But what I do worry about is the crack in confidence among the people that really need to move the campaign. And I think that is what the Congressional Black Caucus is missing. I can't speak about the squad, but I suspect it's something very similar.
I want to pivot to the content of the news conference. I mean, Donald Trump has repeatedly criticized Biden over the amount of funding the U.S. has approved for NATO and Ukraine. Biden, in his news conference, addressed his unconditional support for both NATO and Ukraine in his opening remarks Thursday, as he read off a teleprompter, appealing to U.S. voters.
For those who thought NATO's time had passed, they got a rude awakening when Putin invaded Ukraine. Some of the oldest and deepest fears in Europe roared back to life, because once again, a murderous madman was on the march. But this time, no one cowered in appeasement, especially the United States. We collected intelligence that Russia was planning to invade Ukraine months before the invasion. I directed the intelligence community to be a significant amount of intelligence be declassified so so I could start building an international coalition to oppose the invasion. Then in February, some of you remember, I warned the world that the invasion was imminent. I rallied a coalition of 50 nations from Europe to Asia to help Ukraine defend itself.
So that was President Biden opening his news conference, his 59-minute news conference last night. I want to bring Medea Benjamin as well into this conversation. She's co-author of the new book, NATO, What You Need to Know, and also co-wrote War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. Your response to President Biden last night?
Well, he also said, Amy, does NATO make the world safer? And he put that forward as a question. And I would say that we should say a resounding no. NATO is an aggressive, secretive, military/nuclear alliance that has led us into wars around the world, that is a cover for U.S. aggression around the world, that keeps the war in Ukraine going, guarantees that it will be going on for years to come, and that has put its tentacles all over the world, has called China a threat to the NATO alliance. And I think the bragging of Biden that since he came in, there were only 9 members of NATO that had fulfilled the goal of spending more money on the military. Now there are 23. He and Trump are vying for who is responsible for that. But I think we should question, do the people of the NATO countries really want to spend more money on the military? If they were given a chance in a democratic fashion to answer that, they would say no. So I think that Trump's and Biden both are actually supporting NATO, despite the things that Trump might say once in a while. Both are militarist, both are hawkish. And I also have to say, Amy, that when I look at Biden, I do see a very old, tottering man, but I also see babies that have been bombed and mutilated and starved in Gaza. And let's remember, there has been a grassroots campaign, uncommitted votes in key states, abandoned Biden for many months now. And there are many people who say that we cannot vote for a man who not only green-lighted, but has been a partner in the genocide in Gaza.
Let me bring Bill Fletcher back in, labor activist and co-founder of the Ukrainian Solidarity Network. Your response to President Biden's positions on Ukraine and NATO, which he continually talked about last night, is great pride in increasing the size of NATO, you know, most recently bringing in Sweden and Norway.
So let me divide that into two, Amy. One is that, in my opinion, NATO should never have been formed in the first place, that at the end of the Cold War, NATO should have been dissolved, that there should not have been the inclusion of any other countries in the NATO. And so I do not look at NATO as a force for peace. I in general, agree with Mattia's overall comments about NATO. NATO is not keeping the Ukraine war going. Russia is, Putin is. You know, those people that were suggesting that a cessation of military assistance to Ukraine would bring about peace, well, when the Putin Republicans decided to withhold or restrict money going to Ukraine, that would have been a marvelous moment for Putin to have stepped forward and say, okay, let's now talk peace. Instead, what he said, and was very clear, that now that he had Ukraine on the ropes, as far as he was concerned, that let's go for the goal. So I think that we've got to get our positions clear on this. I think that Biden is stuck in an old frame, an old Cold War frame when it comes to NATO. And
we're losing you again, but respond on the issue of Ukraine, Bill.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure what part was lost. I'm saying that it was Putin who is extending the war in Ukraine, that when the Republicans cut the money, that was an excellent opportunity for Putin to have said, all right, let's negotiate a settlement. He did not. Right. So he has his own objectives, and we shouldn't misunderstand those. That's separate from whether NATO is an instrument of peace, which it is not. It is not. And ultimately, there'll need to be a different kind of security arrangement for European countries, and it should not involve the United States.
I wanted to ask Medea Benjamin about what's happening at the Republican and Democratic conventions. By the way, Democracy Now! Will be in Milwaukee next week. We're expanding to 2 hours Monday through Friday each day to cover the Republican National Convention, and in Chicago next week, at the next month, to cover the Democratic National Convention. A major editorial from the New York Times editorial board says Donald Trump is unfit for a second term. They just published this. It says he's dangerous in word, deed, and action. He's dangerous. He puts self over country. He puts self over country. He loathes the laws we live by. He loathes the laws we live by. Medea Benjamin, what are the protest plans for next week and next month?
Well, first, I have to respond to Bill, because I think that it's important to note that Biden said last night he would not talk to Putin, and that has been his position for the last 2 years. The only way to solve the war in Ukraine is by negotiations, and this is directly connected to NATO, because NATO has said that Ukraine has an irreversible path towards membership in NATO, which is something that Russia has been entirely against. And that means this war will keep escalating instead of looking for a solution. And in the NATO declaration statement that it came out with at the end of the summit, there is not a word about diplomacy. In terms of the conventions, Trump is not fit for office. Trump is a danger for us and the world. And so we, Code Pink and many other organizations, will be at the convention in Milwaukee on the streets and hopefully, if possible, on the inside, protesting the platforms of the Republican convention, protesting Trump as a candidate, just as we will be at the Democratic convention protesting the platform, and, we don't know who the candidate will be there.
And on the inside, David Dayan, I want to end with you talking about this latest news about Nancy Pelosi, who wields great power still as the House Speaker Emerita, clearly will not accept Biden saying he's not stepping aside, though he said it's definitive, it's done. She said we're waiting for him to make his decision. And the latest news is her and Obama speaking together. Obama, who Biden and President Obama, there is tension going back to when President Biden said, back in 2015, that Obama pushed him not to run, and then Hillary ran and lost to President Trump. He feels he could have won. But the significance of, do you feel this is going to make a difference at this point?
Well, it's certainly significant. I mean, I also think it's a little bit unseemly that the power brokers of the Democratic Party are getting in a room and trying to come up with some machination to throw out a sitting president. I don't think anybody looks good here. I don't think Biden, certainly with sort of his denial of certain realities about the polling, realities about his mental acuity, I don't think looks great. And I don't think, this sort of elite class of the Democratic Party looks terribly great trying to, basically spooked by polls and trying to push out somebody who was voted for in a number of primaries, although there wasn't really much of a primary process. I think the problem is larger. I think the problem is that there is no sort of ability for the mass voice of the Democratic base to get involved in these kinds of conversations, maybe by through Sean Fain in a mass membership organization like the UEW. We can see a difference there. But ultimately, this is an insider conversation being driven by insiders, and the public doesn't really have a voice.
Well, we're going to continue, of course, this discussion next week, 2 hours a day, Milwaukee time, 7 to 9, Eastern time, 8 to 10, Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global news hour in Milwaukee, from the 15th to the 19th. David Dayen, thanks so much for being with us, executive director of the American Prospect. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, author of a new book on NATO and previously on Ukraine. And Bill Fleck, labor, racial justice, and international activist. We want to thank you all for joining us. This is Democracy Now! Coming up, I'm Bored So I Shoot. The Israeli news outlet 972 magazine interviews 6 Israeli soldiers following their release from active duty in Gaza. They describe being authorized to open fire on Palestinians virtually at will. We'll speak with a reporter who broke the story. Stay with us. اقعد على دربك وردك Barude. The rifle has shown itself. Palestinian protest song from the 1930s, adapted by Sana Musa. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In early June, Al Jazeera aired a series of videos showing Israeli soldiers shooting dead several Palestinians walking near a coastal road in Gaza. This is an excerpt of that report.
We're going to begin this news hour with videos emerging out of Gaza appearing to show summary executions of Palestinians by Israeli soldiers. Al Jazeera has obtained the videos, and let me give you a warning. Some of you might find them disturbing. We're choosing not to show the moment of death in the videos. They were taken around Al-Rashid Street. That's the coastal road connecting north and south Gaza. Israel has designated it as a safe zone for Palestinians wanting to move between the areas. This footage is from June 1st. It shows a person walking along the beach. Israeli soldiers appear to have stopped them, and moments later, the person is shot. This next video is set to show a group of Palestinians walking north on May 17th. One of them steps out of the group and raises their hands in the air, apparently showing that they're unarmed. They're shot within minutes. Then the video appears to show soldiers coming in to take the person's body away. And in this footage, another person is standing in the same area with their hands in the air. This is shortly before they're shot by Israeli soldiers. The same then happens to another person later.
In each incident shown in that Al Jazeera report, the Palestinians shot dead by Israeli soldiers appear to be unarmed and are at a distance from the soldiers. According to a new investigative article by the Israeli news outlets 972 magazine and Local Call, these executions are consistent with the testimonies of 6 Israeli soldiers following their release from active duty in Gaza in recent months. The 6 soldiers describe being authorized to open fire on Palestinians virtually at will. The sources describe the near total absence of firing regulations in Gaza, with Israeli troops shooting as they please, setting homes ablaze, leaving corpses on the streets, all with their commander's permission. The article's headline, "I'm Bored, So I Shoot, the Israeli Army's Approval of Free-for-All Violence in Gaza." We're joined now by the journalist who broke the story. Oren Zeev is a reporter and photographer for Plus 972 magazine. He's joining us from outside Venice, Italy. Oren, welcome to Democracy Now! I'm bored, so I shoot. First, talk about that Al Jazeera footage that we're seeing, the footage that was taken on the coastal road in Gaza. And then that quote.
Thank you so much for having me. So first of all, the footage we've just seen from Al Jazeera is aligned with many testimonies we have been hearing from Palestinians over the last month that they're prevented from going back north, Palestinians that had to run away or to flee to the southern part of Gaza as the Israeli army ordered. And this footage is aligned also what we are hearing during our investigation from the six soldiers. Basically, they're saying they had almost a complete freedom to open fire. So we've been doing researches and investigation on the past from the attacks from the air using AI and machine learning. And in this investigation, we talked to soldiers who were deployed during the war in different places and different units on the ground. And what they're saying basically is that whenever they had a slight sense of fear or danger, they could shoot. Nobody would limit them. And even sensitive targets, schools, hospital, public institutions that officially had to get approval from higher ranks, this was only a bureaucratical step, and it was almost always approved. In addition, one of the soldiers described, and actually two, that in some areas when the Israeli soldiers were deployed in a specific neighborhood inside the Gaza Strip, they would have a red line, a specific point, hundreds of meters from them, that if a Palestinian, even unarmed, even a woman or a child, would cross, they would be allowed to shoot in order to kill, not to arrest or warn them. And they said that every man between the age of 16 and 50, even in civilian clothes, even unarmed, was considered a fighter or a collaborator with Hamas, and it was allowed to shoot them.
And the quote, the headline of your piece in 972 magazine, I'm bored, so I shoot.
Yes, so many of the times from our investigation, it seems soldiers were shooting not from a tactical reason or a real military reason, but just out of being bored to pass the time or just because they could. Some of the soldiers spoke to us about the, quote, regular fire, meaning that you shoot, and after you shoot, you say on the army radio that it is normal or regular fire, so other units in the area, and there were many soldiers deployed at the beginning of the war inside the Gaza Strip, will know that this is a shooting by the Israeli army and not by Hamas fighters. But they said that this term, regular or normal shooting, was also to kind of state, in other words, I'm just shooting for fun. One of the soldiers said that in Hanukkah, the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, some of the units in the Gaza Strip talked on the radio to shoot on a certain time to kind of light the sky, and they were just shooting for minutes just for fun. So I think this is one aspect, but it also teaches us that this was a very wide policy. It wasn't just a sporadic problem here and there, but a very wide policy that soldiers felt they can do whatever they want, that they won't be accountable. And all this is done also with the awareness of the commanders. I must add also that because from day one of the war, we heard very horrific statements from Netanyahu, from the Prime Minister Netanyahu, from senior ministers in the Israeli government talking about revenge, talking about there's no innocent civilians in Gaza. And this went down to the commanders and down to the simple soldiers. And the soldiers that spoke to us in our investigation said that these kind of phrases, there's no innocent people in Gaza, everybody is involved in Hamas. On October 7, they were all celebrating, this is why they need to be punished, was very widely common. And this is why the soldier who spoke to us explained that the acts of vandalism, of looting, of general sense of revenge were very common.
Oren Ziv, all but one of the six Israeli soldiers you interviewed spoke on the condition of anonymity. A 26-year-old reservist from Jerusalem named Yuval Green. In November and December, Yuval served in the 55th Paratroopers Brigade. He recently signed a letter by 41 reservists declaring their refusal to fight in Gaza after the Israeli army's invasion of Rafah. Green said, quote, there were no restrictions on ammunition. People were shooting just to relieve the boredom. Well, on Thursday evening, Democracy Now! Reached Yuval Green in Jerusalem and asked him what he's calling for now.
I believe that continuing this war and continuing the death of Palestinians and Israeli soldiers is not right. I believe that right now, the right thing to do is to sign the ceasefire treaty that is going to release the hostages and end this war. I know that the Israeli government is not yet willing to sign it.
Again, that's Yuval Green, a reservist who is now refusing to fight in Gaza. All of the six that you interviewed were reservists there. You also write, the testimonies paint a landscape littered with civilian corpses, which are left to rot or be eaten by stray animals. The army only hides them from view ahead of the arrival of international aid convoys so that images of people in advanced stages of decay don't come out. Go from Yuval to this picture of Gaza.
I think what several soldiers told us, that the army was not dealing with dead people, dead Palestinians, and it was very common to see them on the side of the roads when they're moving to one place to another. And also Yuval himself and other soldiers told us that when the army was moving from, so Israeli soldiers were deployed inside Palestinian homes and houses, and when they had to move to a new position, the official policy, as we understood, was to burn the house down. The soldiers would gather the mattresses and the furniture and light the house on fire and move on. The official explanation by the commanders to Yuval, but also to other soldiers, was the fact that they don't want to anything sensitive to be left there, military equipment or maps or anything like that, but also that Hamas will not use the houses. But between the lines, you can understand that this was also an act of revenge to punish Palestinian civilians and also to make sure they cannot go back to those areas that at least some people in the army believed would stay in Israeli control.
Yuval also told you, Yuval Green, who is the only one to be named in your piece, about the army's deep indifference to the fate of the hostages. Can you elaborate further? Indeed, of course, as we know, in December, the Israeli soldiers shot and killed three Israeli hostages as they approached the troops for help, speaking in Hebrew with their arms up, stripped down so that they could the Israeli military would clearly see they weren't armed. These are hostages.
Yes, thank you for the question. The official line of the Israeli government and the Israeli army, the top commander, is that the operation in Gaza, the war in Gaza, is also in order to bring back the hostages alive. Now, in 9 months of war, this didn't really happen. They managed to rescue a very small number of hostages alive by military force. Most of the hostages were released in a deal in November. And the soldier we spoke to, not only Yuval Green, said that in general, there were not many instructions regarding hostages. And in the way the army was using shooting on the ground, was using force, for them it was clear that hostages might get hurt or even killed. I think in addition to Yuval, there was another soldier that was on the regular army service that said they didn't have any cell phone, they didn't get any news, and he heard about the three hostages being killed on December only when he got back home for a short vacation. Now, after the killing of the three hostages by the Israeli army, the army said in statement that they would make it more clear for soldiers, but at least according to the soldier we spoke to that was on the front line, they didn't hear even about the incident, not to speak about new orders or guidelines.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Oren Zeev, reporter and photographer for Plus 972 magazine. We're going to link to your piece, I'm Bored, So I Shoot, the Israeli Army's Approval of Free-for-All Violence in Gaza. That does it for our show. Next week, Democracy Now! Will be in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the Republican National Convention, bringing you an extended daily two-hour broadcast, Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Radio Rewind.